Blog Talk Radio.
Actors Julia Armand and Bill Pullman discuss their new film, Surveillance, and the movie geeks have a little bit of the latest movie news in a roundtable discussion tonight on Movie Geeks United. Welcome to the show, everybody. Good to have you guys on board tonight, live or in the archive. This is Movie Geeks United, this Sunday night. How you doing, Jerry?
I'm doing very well. How are you, Jamie?
I'm good. I am a big fan of cranberry juice. Do you know that about me?
I did not know that about you. That's very good to know, though.
I find myself buying lots of cranberry juice. It's not that I have any kind of kidney or urinary tract infection. It's just, I like the taste of it.
Well, that's good. I didn't even know about the medical side of it, but thanks for sharing that with us.
Yeah, yeah. I just wanted to start us out on that note because it's only uphill from there.
It really is.
We got a lot to talk about tonight, a lot of movie topics that we'll be discussing in about a half hour or so. So we got some good stuff coming up. But we're starting out the show tonight with two conversations with great actors from the new film Surveillance, Julia Armand and Bill Pullman. And Jerry, you just saw Surveillance, right?
I just saw Surveillance, and it is disturbingly brilliant.
Disturbingly brilliant?
Yeah.
Okay, any elaboration?
I'll say this. It's night and day. A lot of people, obviously, from the interview that Aaron did with her, Jennifer Lynch, a couple of weeks ago, about boxing Helena, put all that aside. This really should have been the first film from her, but it isn't. It's the second film, but the film works on so many levels. I have to say it easily is the best horror film I've seen this year or maybe even last year, and I watched Dead Snow this week, if that's any indication. But it's a very disturbing. It pulls at your heartstrings at many levels. It just works.
Mm-hmm.
The film is just really, and it keeps you guessing. You don't want to leave. You don't want to, you're engrossed into what's going on. So I got to hand it to her. She really, as obviously there are some scenes that are influenced from her father, but she's really come out on her own on this one.
So you would consider it a horror film?
I consider, with the way the film turns out, but also just with the depiction of the view of law enforcement in this film is nihilistic at best. because the way it's going, the film you think is going one way, then it goes another way, but
right.
Its depiction of authority, not just law, just authority in general, even parenting in that regard, is nihilistic,
yeah.
I think. Just from what I've seen on this initial viewing, but it's a damn good film.
Yeah, well, I'm happy that you enjoyed it.
Yeah. I don't know if enjoy is the right word.
Yeah, that might be stretching it a bit.
Yeah.
Okay, let's take a listen. This is a conversation we had with the two stars of the film, starting with Miss Julia Armand. I was wondering what your reaction was when you first read the script.
I loved it. I mean, my first reaction was that it was very clever and that it surprised me and that I thought it would be in great hands in terms of being done by Jen, and then instantly moved on to, and of course there's not a hope in hell of me getting in it because they would never think of casting me, so that it was to sort of And my manager, Chris Proffa, said, you know, well, you're seeing David today, you're looping, so why don't you ask him? And I'm like, no, that's your job. I'd be embarrassed. And, you know, what if he just wants to say no and that'll make him embarrassed? And he said, oh, stopping such a wuss. And so so I did. I asked David at the looping if they would consider me. And he said, for what role? And I said, the 9-year-old. You think I'm too old? And then he said, and then I said, you know, the FBI agent, and he said, well, you know, she never does what I tell her, but let me let her know. And then I got to meet with Jen and begged her for the role. And I think at some point she said something along the lines of, can you afford to take a risk on something like this? And I said, I don't feel I can afford not to.
Right. Well, tell me more about that, because obviously the story, her the screenplay is extraordinary, but what about the character itself seemed like a particular challenge to you?
I think for me that the way that I speak about it is, you know, I play an FBI agent, and for me it was, for one step as an actor, for me I found that it's been really tricky for me to get modern American roles. And something that cuts up against or bucks up against what I'm usually, the type of work I'm usually offered, which tends to be classical period, weepy,
sure,
people who kill themselves. And that particularly what drew me was the sort of the temperature of the piece and the tone and style of the piece, that those are definitely movies that I don't get to do.
Right.
And so that was really what drew me to it. And that's kind of how I talk about it.
When you play this, was there a concept or an image or something that you used as a beacon to drive you through to create that character?
No, not really. I think I got it from the script, and I think what I liked about it, and what I often find, what I liked about it was that each of these characters have flaws.
Uh-huh.
Each of these characters are a product of their past. It's very much an ensemble piece. And I think has a really terrific ensemble cast, and all credit for Jen for, you know, getting the performances she did out of all of us. And that for me is what draws the audience in. It's like the humor of it, which is dark humor, and where I find myself laughing at stuff while I'm kind of like, well, hang on a minute, because that's actually not that nice for that character, that maybe that character is going to get killed and I really shouldn't be laughing at this.
Sure.
There was something tonally in it that reminded me of Reservoir Dogs, and I'm not making any comment on the success of the movie or anything like that, or but there was something that tonally about the humor reminded me of Reservoir Dogs, but then at the heart of it, it also has this innocent child.
Yeah.
That makes it, as a piece, feel different all the way through.
Mm.
And it took me a while to work out what's the surveillance part of it. Like, I kind of just accepted the title and went to work, and then every now and again, the question comes up, why surveillance as a title? And it took me a while to kind of process what I feel about that. And I guess I see it as something that surveillance is something that the authorities do.
Right.
And it's people watching us in order to piece together the truth with the uber objective of keeping us safe. But how judgment plays a role in that. But what they're only ever looking at is fragments of something and fragments of the truth.
Right.
Whereas this child at the center of it, whose innocence and connectedness to other people is what makes her be the observer of the ultimate truth.
Yeah. And for you as an actor, is there value in working with children? Because you look at children and they're so open. and honest. And there's, they have nothing, none of the blockades that adults tend to have.
No, they don't. And it, I mean, the, I could say, hand on heart, all of the children I have worked with are unbelievably professional. And and also how, I think this is probably the second time.
Mm-hmm.
Second time I've worked with a kid in a somewhat adult dark film that I think potentially, you know, raises a question for people of, is it appropriate for a child to be in a film like that? What's going to happen to the child? You know, is that going to be psychologically disturbing for the child? And I can honestly say, as somebody who really would not want to participate in something that was disturbing for a child, children have an amazing sense of play.
Mm-hmm.
And what kids do in movies, for the most part, is be way more natural and able to dive into the play, the role playing, than we are. And that's Abigail Breslin. It's, you know, all of these kids that I've worked with have just got an incredible facility for, well, they don't have the boundaries. They don't have the, you know, they're not battling inhibitions that maybe you have, that maybe I feel I might have as an adult. So,
right.
But also when you have them in circumstances of blood and accidents or violence, they are so, it's like Halloween night for them.
Mm-hmm.
It has the same kind of approach of, this is ketchup, it looks like my head is bleeding. And that's how they put it together. And, you know, so long, it's much more about how is that child treated on set? Are their rights as a child actor observed? Do they get to go do their schooling? Are they not pushed to, in terms of their hours? You know, I can honestly say all of the parents around the kids that I've worked with have been great. And so I think there's much more safety in that than maybe is perceived from the outside when you suddenly see a film cut together.
Right, right.
And it, in effect, delivers something far darker.
When you saw the finished product, obviously having been with it throughout the birthing process, did anything about it surprise you, the finished film?
I was just really happy with the result that she came up with. I mean, having been in it and having been part of the process, there were surprising things that happened, I guess, in the making of the film. There was, there were definitely surprises there for me, but just pleasantly surprised that I felt she captured it and brought it all together. And I guess also, yes, what I did get to see was a lot of work that I hadn't been part of. And just thought there was sort of terrific performances from, you know, a lot of people who I hadn't gotten to work with.
Yeah, you know, you've been obviously very successful in bigger budgeted movies like Benjamin Button, which was my favorite movie last year, by the way.
Aww, thank
and
you.
Yeah, at the independent films like this one, I'm wondering if it affects your acting, your freedom as an actor, being on a set like Surveillance.
I think because Surveillance for me felt like it was just very finally feeling lucky to have been cast in something that was so different to the usual stuff that I get to do. That was liberating, but I say that in the context of I've loved doing the other stuff that I've done.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the two things that I would say are liberating, one is I feel freer as an actor as I feel I have gained more experience in it. And I think that as a young actor, I would have in my head a sense of what the director wanted, or maybe my ideas that I was bringing to the table. And if in a filming circumstances they would say, okay, so let's try this, or maybe it should be that. Mm-hmm. Instead, I would have a lot of fear around, I don't know that I can do that. And now I kind of feel as an actor that having played a range of different stuff, it's kind of like, okay, all right, I hear you, let's try it. And I see that makes you more flexible as an actor. I definitely feel that as I've gotten older, I've gotten more flexible. And I also find the age thing liberating. It's an odd thing for a woman to say in film. But I really have found that the roles that I have gotten to play more recently have been much more liberating in allowing me to go out on a limb, do something that I haven't done before, that breaks away from the need to just be pretty.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this question, my last question, then I'll let you off the hook. I thank you so much for your time, but this is a pretty loaded question. It goes along with what you've just been saying, because we had Miss Lynch on the show last week, and obviously she took a long hiatus after her debut film, and she felt like she had come to this one a deeper, kind of more mature artist. And I'm wondering, looking back, your reasons for getting into acting, how have those morphed and deepened for you over the years?
Well, I know when I set out on the path, I can remember saying to somebody that I love doing this, but I really want to still be doing it when I'm 35 and on.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, my kind of period of stepping away to get myself out of a rut, I don't want to characterize it as some people do, as turning my back on something, but more kind of feeling that I'd gotten myself through my own choices into a rut, that I had to step out in order to find another way to step back in if they would have me.
Mm-hmm.
And doing that right at the point as you're moving towards mid-30s or whatever was kind of icky timing. And that's never an easy thing to do. People want the assurance of, we've seen you do this before, we'd like you to do it in a different way in this project.
Yeah.
And what actually I felt like I had to kind of start again and build it up again slowly with more range, and that took a while.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think you're fantastic. I've always loved everything you've done, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for your time.
Next time you need to pee, someone goes with you.
I'm a witness, not a suspect.
I know what you are. And I also know how to perform a cavity search.
Wow, I haven't done a girl since art school.
Oh, it's just like riding a bike.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, girls. We'll do the interview separately. So, Janet and the officers will show you where to go.
Sam, go easy.
Easy?
Yeah, remember why we're here.
I remember why we're here, Agent. I'm good.
Real good.
When you first received the script for Surveillance, I know that you had interaction with Jennifer throughout the years, but what were your first impressions when you saw the script?
Well, you know, she has, as she tells the world, I turned her down first, but I, you know, there was a period like a year before we did the movie where she had sent me the script, and I love her and known her for a long time and really wanted to do it, but I didn't, you know, it was a violent movie that I didn't hear her voice in it, you know, at that point, and I don't know whether it was me or her, but, it, you know, I think she did do some more work on it, and when I read it the second time, and I was really glad to suddenly see it all and from her perspective, and I could hear her voice in the lines and the dialogue and things, and went on board.
And so, in your estimation, what is her voice?
Well, it's this incredible, cheeky sense of humor in these most horrific moments of human behavior. And I think she has this kind of curious ability to, you know, not go to, like, just moralistic judgment of human behavior, but to kind of celebrate it, that most aberrance, its aberrance, and as a way of kind of acknowledging who we are and getting to the truth of who we are.
Yeah. We talked to her last, Jennifer, last week, and she's fantastic. Yeah, and I'm going to be the millionth and first person to ask you this, but obviously you've worked with both Jennifer and her father, David, and I would think that Jennifer might be a bit more communicative in terms of the context of the scene, but I would think also that they both allow you an incredible amount of freedom as an actor, too.
Well, yeah, I think Jennifer definitely is, you know, comes out of a much more psychological orientation than David's, more like a dream oriented, imagistic. You know, he comes from the an art program, and Jennifer's always seems to have come through more psychological storytelling. So there is a lot more that Jennifer will say, but David's very communicative in his own unique way, and but I think they both have a, you know, a great sense of joy on the set, and when you're working on the movies, you feel like you've got the best job in the world.
Yeah, and what was the particular challenge of, you've done so many kinds of roles, and I'm wondering, this role in Surveillance, what did you find particularly challenging?
Well, we had to shoot fast, and there's a lot of things that where we got into the room to actually shoot that had to just be there, and you had to stay incredibly focused during those periods, and and I think also to surrender to this thing that happened. But it, once you got on board, once I really Jennifer really was allowing Julia and I to see this incredible amount of swagger and joy and that was, once we got on it, it wasn't that hard. It wasn't that hard to get to.
But you've done both bigger budgeted films, obviously, and the indie films such as this one. And you've spoken a little bit to this just now, but does that affect your acting style? Is it particularly freeing to be in a lower budgeted film in some ways?
Well, you know, there's a lot in lower budget movies. You never know what the heck is going to come out, you know, whether you ever see it or what will happen. You know, the process of doing it is quite enjoyable, usually. I mean, sometimes the conditions are extreme. But, with a more studio budgeted movie, there's the good and the bad of having a lot of hands on board. Is one is that they're going to edit the crap out of the thing and maximize everything they can, and the possibility the movie is going to get seen is more likely, which has got its own gratitude, not to be dismissed. You know, I don't think that necessarily they both are important. You know, in these times it's harder and harder to get independent movies, you know, out there or get some kind of consensus where people are buying them and that kind of thing, but I think they both are important, you know.
Yeah, very important. And with this film, it's obvious that she has a very unique voice. And I was telling Julia earlier that I'm just so thankful for movies that I haven't seen before that surprise me.
Oh, good. Yeah, so, yeah. I think she does have, this kind of surprising way of activating actors at, I think everybody in the movie shares this kind of bizarre style of bravura style acting, you know, but very truthful, authentic, but every actor acts like they're the balls, you know, and it's kind of you realize it's not often where you get to see that kind of thing where everybody is not just doing a nice representational job of characters, but I mean, actually has a lot of swagger, and they're all competing with each other in this way.
Yeah, and the world of the film is conducive to that. It's all part of the fabric of the movie, too. When you saw it, did the finished product, having gone through the process of giving birth to it, what surprised you about it?
Well, you know, it's disturbing. And I was, you know, really, sometimes, you know, they're a joy to watch, and sometimes they're, you know, it's really disturbing. And I know there's a lot of humor in it, and I laughed a few times and, you know, uncomfortably, but then mm-hmm. it's not something that you come across that often. So it stays with you, and I keep thinking about it, and you know, it's one of those where the images come back, and it's surprisingly simple context, but in a way, the way that the story unravels and the puzzles it asks about the people and who they are and what their motives are, you know, you keep pondering it.
Yeah, you sure do. With the I'm wondering, we spoke with Jennifer last week, and she said that she took a hiatus, obviously, between her debut film and this one, and she felt like she deepened and matured a lot as an artist in that time. And I'm curious, from you, when you started out in the acting profession till now, how do you think the main ways are that you've matured and the process has deepened for you?
Well, you know, I've been lucky to keep doing a lot of variety of different things, and I think you know, the idea of what you can accomplish simply, you know, has taken on more power. I think, you know, there's a certain kind of zenness that comes into it, where you realize, you know, you've got to really be, you know, like even with this character, which is not necessarily an orthodox character, but it can really simplify a few things and manifest them completely. It's better than trying to, you know, I think I used to spend a lot of time doing, you know, very complicated sets of things, whereas now sometimes they can put together one notion that Jennifer says with one rock and roll riff, and I'm off and running, you know.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's an efficiency in a way.
Yeah, that's probably it. Yeah.
This is exciting to me. Before I let you go, I got to ask you about this. If I'm not mistaken here, you're doing Oleana?
Yes.
That is terrific.
Yes, we're doing it. Julia Stiles and I am here at the Taper in L.A., and we're pretty good that we're going to go to New York in the fall. So.
Oh, wow. Have you done much Mamet before?
No, I never have done it. So it's that part of it. You know, I had done a couple of Edward Albee plays, but I hadn't really done this. And I often wondered whether I'd get caught in that snare that sometimes happens, where the stuff becomes a little too mannered or the language doesn't sound organic. But I think we've pushed past that and trying to look at this play, which you know, had been last done in New York in the 1992-93, and been gratifying to get notices that suggest people are looking at it from a different perspective now.
It's a terrific play, and like all Mamet, it's very specific for the actor. Did you feel at all that it was constructive at all, that dialogue?
Well, yeah, there's certain, you know, kind of they're both incredibly become verbal in ways that you know, are part of what they mask themselves with. So there's a use of language that's different than in other kinds of things, where so you have an incredibly dense syntax, or you get a lot of like self-editing, where they'll start a sentence, shift to another sentence, shift to another sentence, you know, as they're trying to negotiate with each other. So you really gotta get a certain technical ability with all of that before you can then start to manifest all the other stuff that's going on underneath it.
Okay, that's Bill Pullman and Julia Armand. The movie is Surveillance. It's available now, video on demand services, and in theaters June 26th. So there you go. It was good. We even got to talk a little bit about Mammoth in there.
No, that's incredible. Sure, two great actors, really great interviews on your part.
You know what was funny? Mammoth was on Blog Talk Radio. I think one of the co-hosts, when Mammoth was on, wasn't quite sure who he was. And so
that's
he kept pronouncing his name Mehmet.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I always think of that now whenever I say the name David Mamet. Okay, Chris, how you doing, man?
Hey, doing
hey,
great.
Chris.
Hey. How, guy.
What is it, like the Fonzie reunion? I mean,
how's your Father's Day been?
It was great until I found out that someone who had David Mamet on didn't know who he was.
So. Well, you know, it's Blog Talk Radio. Chris, it's Blog Talk Radio. What do you expect?
Yeah. Fortunately, I have to commit a murder now, so.
Can I join you?
Yeah. No, oh, yeah, actually, absolutely, if it's going to take any of the heat off me, sure.
Yeah.
Chris, I went to the movies last night.
Oh, my God. You went to the
yes.
talkies? Oh, Dan, you went to the... Shut the automobile to the talkies.
I went to see Up.
Ah.
Because it was starting at that time, I went and saw the Dolby Digital 3D thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And,
which that's
so,
a movie that I don't think, I think would play equally well, in either.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. I don't think that the 3D was entirely necessary.
No, it wasn't. It was a beautiful film.
It is terrific. It is terrific. I loved it. There's so just clever writing.
Oh, yeah.
Like, clever direction. I mean, you don't think about those films actually being directed by people. You know, as stubborn as that sounds.
And the last two films, this and Wall-E, are so much better than most of the live-action films that were out in their respective years, especially Up. I mean, it really is far ahead of the herd as far as other films go this year.
As far as Up goes, I liked it a lot, but I thought that the first hour was it was kind of front-loaded with really strong stuff, and then the last hour of it was more of just a, kind of a standard children's movie, I thought. But
I would give you that, Chris, but do you even think the scene, and I guess it's because it's been out almost a month, I can say this, the scene where he looks at the photo album?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, that was a good scene. I just thought it started to get... Where it was very believable was in the beginning. There weren't a lot of ridiculous... You know, you weren't... he was an old man. You know, had to have a walker to get around. Then by the end of the movie, all of a sudden, he's, you know, using his walker as a zip line from plane to plane in the middle of... And it started to get a little bit more... ask a little bit more of you. But,
right.
No.
I understand that. Yes, I understand. Yeah, I know.
I did think that the midsection had problems. I thought the midsection got a little routine,
mm-hmm.
and it kind of strayed away from what was so enchanting about it from the beginning, by that first hour. But yeah, it's just it's a great experience.
It is.
And I never go see Disney movies at the
You
theater.
Never go see anything animated. I'm shocked.
You never go see anything.
Well, no, he does. No, Chris, animated and Jamie Duval usually don't exist in the same.
Well, that's absolutely true.
God, you guys are ganging up on me.
No, I wouldn't gang up on you, baby.
No, that's fine, baby. But I saw some other movies. You know, the show's all about me. So I thought that I'd just bring you on, Chris, so I could talk about the movies that I've seen.
Please.
But I did catch a lot this weekend of older movies that I hadn't seen yet. Not old movies, but recent year.
Mm-hmm.
Fanboys, which I didn't quite like. I just thought, you know, blah, whatever.
Let me ask you that. I watched that on Tuesday night. Did you just feel that was sort of like run-of-the-mill, we'll take advantage of all the current comedians, that like comic actors that are out there? And
probably. But honestly, when I heard the plot, and when we had the guys on the show, I did think it was a great idea. And actually, my favorite part was the very last line.
That's the greatest line in the whole movie.
That is great.
Because you're building up to it. You're like, guys, this movie will kill you if it didn't kill you before.
Yeah, I also saw Australia.
Did you like Australia?
You know what? I did like it.
Thank you.
You know, it takes a lot for me to say that it doesn't quite work as well as it should,
mm-hmm.
because obviously there's so much effort that went into that film, and there's so much effort that goes into every film, but
mm-hmm.
you feel like a particular jerk when you criticize a movie like Australia.
Yeah, I wouldn't criticize it.
But he's going for his Kids Gone with the Wind, and it has three or four very nice big movie moments
mm-hmm.
that feel like it could be part of that canon.
Oh, yeah.
I think Hugh Jackman works really well. I think the child works really well. It's inventively directed by him. So I had little problems with that. I was more just apathetic to
it.
Not
enough, though, to derail the experience of watching the film, though.
Yeah, but I watched the film and I enjoyed it.
Oh, I loved it.
There wasn't any particular surge of engagement on my part in the film, really. So I didn't get really excited about it, but I enjoyed what I saw. Three movies I did see that I was really excited about, and this first one would probably bear some conversation between the three of us, was The Reader. I had never seen The Reader, and I watched it, and I loved it.
What did you love about it? I'm curious. What did you love about it?
I thought it was fantastic. I thought things about this film were fantastic that no one's been talking about. I thought the boy was incredible in that movie.
Okay, the boy's good. Okay, tell me what were the other things you liked about it. No, give me the other things. Give me the other things, baby. Give me the other things.
I think it was a very engaging story, and I didn't find it to be cold at all. I thought it was very emotional. I got very emotional with Ralph Fiennes. The current story and looking back and trying to deal with his life.
Okay, so far I'm with you. Go to the third thing you liked about the movie.
Obviously, Kate Winslet is excellent. I thought that the actual plot of the film was
let me ask you this: did you not feel he was going to make her brownies and cake and cookies and everything and bring it to her in prison? The way the film is going. I don't mean to sound like a cold fish, but it's just the last third of the film, I'm just like, well, why don't you fucking make her brownies and say, hey, it's all right, you know? The Zionist state will decline in 50 years.
I know. I felt the struggle within him to come to terms with that, because I often wonder about that duality. Was accused of, and obviously she did, and went to prison for. I mean, it's an unspeakable crime.
Mm-hmm.
But should that detract from what that experience meant to him in that formative time of his life?
Oh, okay. If we go on that basis, Jamie, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt, because I think you're a fine son of a bitch, and I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt here. Yeah, on that, I think you're right. I think my problem with this film and my problem with The Boy with the Striped Pajamas, and we've trivialized the Holocaust so much in the last couple of years as far as mainstream movies go.
Right.
I gotta tell you, does anyone even really care anymore? And I'm not being flippant, okay? I'm not being, you know, my usual jackass self here. I'm being,
that's actually a good point.
That was a belt there. That's
actually a good point, because the movie's really actually not about the Holocaust, I don't think.
No, it's not. The Holocaust
doesn't really even need to play a role in that, I don't think. But it does in the way that it expresses him trying to make sense of what this woman meant to him and why that relationship and its aftermath has put such a burden on the rest of his life.
Yeah. No, and I think you actually, that's a good point. And I think because the film is really about him, and the book maybe to a lesser extent, but the film is definitely about him.
Yeah.
And in a sense of the trailer, the trailer that we see, let's be very honest, it's about that character. It's not about Kate Winslet. She's
right.
Besides the point.
Yeah, yeah. I felt the same way. Chris, you didn't see anything except the nude scenes, right?
That's right. Yep.
I want to hear what Chris has to say about the film.
I fast-forwarded to the nude scenes, and then I cleaned up, and I took a nap. And
you didn't feel like watching any Fassbinder after that or Pasolini after that?
No, not at all. No, I thought it was a decent movie, and I agree that it had a lot of good things going for it, but I kind of felt like it was trying to fire on too many different cylinders, and I think that's what you guys are sort of talking about here. Like, it's like a restaurant that serves everything. How good can they be at making anything, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point.
It was trying to tell too many stories, and I thought none of them got past, like, a B, you know? Like, mm-hmm. All of them were told, okay, but they didn't really wrap up. I thought the third act was really, really weak because it just really just sort of fizzles out towards
the
movie. Like, you don't really get any insight into what he's thinking. He takes this trip with his daughter, but not much is really mined there. It just sort of goes over stuff you've already learned, and then it just sort of ends.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with Jamie that it has some really good stuff in it. And,
there's good stuff in it. There's no doubt about it.
There's some good courtroom stuff. Lena Olin and whoever plays Lena Olin's not daughter, because Lena Olin plays that too, but the girl that's in the courtroom with her.
Oh, the daughter has the most important line in the film.
Mm-hmm.
The daughter. That scene at the end sums up the whole entire movie, maybe sums up the whole decade as far as Holocaust movies are concerned, but she has the most important line uttered of last year. Nothing good came from the camps.
Yeah.
And that's whatever you think, one way or the other, that's the summation of the movie, right there.
It is something that, her big shame... her big shame is that she didn't know how to read. It's a delicate balance, because I don't think the movie claws for sympathy for her necessarily, because that wouldn't be justifiable.
I want to say that. I almost want to agree with that, but I just think that it points towards the end where it does, but I'll give you that, Jamie, because it's a troubling film, and that's a sign of a good film, if it's troubling.
If you grapple with it, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's
something
to it.
That's a good sign. But
having said all these great things about it, and I do think a lot of good things about it, the one thing that bothered me most about The Reader was the fact that it was nominated for several Academy Awards, and I did not think it belonged, certainly not in the Best Picture category.
No, not at all.
Kate Winslet belonged in her category, and frankly, I thought that was, of the three, actual film performances from Ralph Fiennes last year, I thought The Reader was the best one, but The Duchess and In Bruges being the other two. But the movie had no business being in the Best Picture category.
No, it was Harvey Weinstein's Power.
What were we fighting for instead of The Reader? Can we even remember now?
Doubt.
Doubt, right. I would have put Doubt over there. Another great movie. I feel so ashamed, because we had Rod Laurie on the show, and I hadn't seen it yet. It was Nothing But the Truth.
It's incredible.
I love that movie. And I didn't realize how affecting it would be. That end scene where the source is kind of revealed, just the implications of that, it's pretty devastating.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, so that's another great movie.
No, it's another great movie, and I think it is something to be said for, because even when we had him on the show, and I love him, he's a great guy, he sells the film short. It really, you want to say it's about, Judith Miller? It's really not, because the Kate Winslet character has so much more going for her than Judith Miller ever did in the first place.
Right.
And it's just an incredible film and a celebration of journalism and what made journalism in this country in the post-Watergate era so great.
Pour me one too, Chris. Go ahead.
Yeah, no problem.
No, you're right. You're right.
Yeah, no,
and
it's really Rod Laurie, he has this thing. I mean, you watch all of his films, but the both leads in this film are very good.
Yeah.
And it's based, obviously, on that.
Alan Alda. Oh.
Alan Alda's very good. I mean, Alan Alda, that's a disturbing portrayal from him. But Kate Beckinsale is good. Vera Farmiga is good. But it's just a very well-done movie. He makes an engrossing political film.
He always does. And the thing about him is, and it does seep through a lot in this one too, he tends to be a little didactic, and I know he was trying to veer away from that here. But there are parts in that. But on the whole, I thought it was very even-handed arguments back and forth on the merits of giving up your source for national security or preserving the First Amendment by not giving up your source for the freedom of the press.
Very good in this film is Matt Dillon.
Yeah, he's good.
He's superb. It's the Bobby Fitzgerald character, and you actually, you know, while he is, I guess you could say, villainous in the film in the way that it's portrayed, you will understand what he's doing. You understand his motivations are very
right.
clear, and you actually have some empathy towards him.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was a very well done film. I'm ashamed that it didn't get, you know, a wider release, but it was very well done.
Yeah. And the last movie I saw was Elegy, which I loved. Loved. Ben Kingsley, Penelope Cruz. A very kind of deceptively simple movie. Because it's about, it seems like it's simple on the outside, but it's about so many things wrapped up in male-female relationships, male views on sex, and aging, particularly as you get older, you know. Do you ever outgrow that kind of your adolescent urges in a way.
Well,
it's a very serious Philip Roth treatment of that kind of stuff.
It's very serious, and it's the first time Philip Roth has worked really great in a film, and you need a woman to do it.
Yeah.
That's what you need, and I would have nominated Penelope Cruz.
I would have, too.
She's
is she phenomenal or what?
Who is also very good, despite his Dennis Hopper. Hopper is actually very good in this film, and you know what scene I'm talking about. It's a very emotionally distraught scene, but he's very good in this, and obviously Ben Kingsley, we don't need to go. He's just great in anything he's in, but this was the sleeper of last summer as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. And it's just that whole Holocaust subplot didn't need to be there.
No, it didn't. let me tell you something. We Jews, we carry around the Holocaust with us. It's like a badge of shame, honor, and regret and guilt. And we carry it around with us wherever we go. God knows Larry David does, too.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about some top... anybody see anything else, guys?
I saw Tetro.
Yes, and you love Tetro, right?
I thought Tetro was incredible.
Can't wait to see it.
It's the first half of the film is the work you would think is the work of a new filmmaker. The second half of the film is the work of someone who's been around for a long time. I would, you know, regardless of what anyone thought about Youth Without Youth, and I'm now really sorry after watching Tetro yesterday in the theater that I didn't see it in the theater because I might have appreciated that film more. Tetro is pretty brilliant. And, you know, I know a lot of people don't like Vincent Gallo. It's my second favorite Vincent Gallo performance outside of Buffalo 66. He finally found someone else who could direct him, and
mm-hmm.
that's Coppola. The other performance to watch for is the younger brother, Benny. Alden
yes.
Emmerich, I think, is... What is the last... Let me find the last name here. Alden Emmerich. And he is great. And there are scenes between the two of them that will remind you of Pacino and John Cazale in Godfather 2. The family dynamics are played out to the full extent, but the amazing thing about the film is that Coppola hasn't lost it. Not at all. I know there's criticisms about the film before this, but forget it.
You know, Youth Without Youth was almost designed to be a cold exercise. I mean, it was designed to be metaphysical.
It was designed. And there are themes from that film. The characters in this one talk about a lot of the issues in Youth Without Youth. So, and you know, even in our interview with him, he said, you know, obviously people didn't want to see a philosophical film. Forget that. I mean, it's the film he made. You felt at the time that was the right film he made. And
mm-hmm.
it was a warm-up for this. And I was not looking forward to Tetro for a while until I read more about it, and then I watched it. It's
something else occurred to me. I was thinking about Godfather 2 and how Godfather 2, and there's parts of that where, like, the boy at Ellis Island, you know, singing in the room, parts of that that just, like, sear in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And they become almost like your own memories.
Yeah.
In a way. But there are moments in that movie that also very slightly call upon the politics of that time. So they feel like they're part of the national kind of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
The talk about the trial, the talk about the buffers that they had to go through to give an order to kill or something, you could easily parable to Watergate. When they shoot Hyman Roth at the airport, it bears more than a striking resemblance to Lee Harvey Oswald's assassination. They're very smart little things that he puts in those films that just make them just not able to leave your mind.
Well, they're not able to leave your mind, but I want to throw this out there. And while we know a lot about Coppola's biography, there's a very domineering father in this film, played by Klaus Maria Brandeir.
Yes.
And he's a conductor, as was Carmine Coppola. And I really don't want to... I don't think we know everything there is to know about his relationship with his father. More importantly, there's a sibling rivalry here.
Yeah, between he and August.
Between he and August, maybe between Sophia and Roman.
Well, I think with August particularly in his own life, because
yeah.
August was supposed to be the big achiever. He was the biggest artist in the family, and he was going to go on to do tremendous things. And it didn't turn out like that. Okay.
Film.
I can't wait to see it. It opens wider. It opens wider as the weeks go on. Go to tetro.com and you'll be able to read all about it. Some topics here. Speaking of the FBI and Watergate and that whole thing, these segues are terrific. Deep Throat. Did you guys hear about Deep Throat?
Which Deep Throat?
I'm aware that there is a movie called Deep Throat.
I'm aware of the guy that was Deep Throat. But
I'm aware of the
Throat?
Activity. Well, Deep Throat, obviously the 1972 porn film that was so popular, it just got released that the FBI was investigating that movie and trying to stop it at the very top level, up to the FBI second in command, who was Mark Felt.
Mm.
And that's how he took the name Deep Throat when he was the source for the Watergate story.
Good for him. No, but I mean, you know, I think that's fine. Obviously, Deep Throat is one of my favorite films. That's cool. Beautiful.
Okay. Here's something that we might be able to talk about. Bruto, obviously coming out July 10th, I think. It started screening here and there, premieres and things. And the Gay and Lesbian Alliance, the group, they want to put a disclaimer on the film. They're urging them to put a disclaimer on it. Here's a question to ponder. We obviously know that it's going to be the same, tonally, probably the same as Borat. Is a movie like Bruno a help or a hindrance to the gay and lesbian equal rights cause?
I don't think it's either one, really.
I think it's both, and it's not. I mean, either or.
Yeah, I mean, how could it be a help, really?
He's the only homosexual character in the film.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that. I mean,
no, he actually is, like, the only, that's the concern, is I guess it's been on the internet the last week or so, but he's the only openly gay character in the film, and they're worried that this is going to, like, just put more jokes and more stereotypes of gay characters for the next years to come. They like the film, but they are aware that there's going to be a huge backlash.
Right, but what is a disclaimer? First of all, what sort of disclaimer are they wanting on there?
I don't know particularly. I think that it's not representative of, you know, all gays. Their point is, and this is an age-old dilemma with filmmakers, people are bring their own perceptions to a film, and you're not going to instill tolerance in them just by getting them in the theater. It could it could accelerate or accentuate their own intolerance by saying it.
I can't believe I'm going to say what I'm about to say, but I'm going to say it because it's my show, goddamn it. You know, before The Passion of the Christ came out, months before, I was worried that maybe there would be some loose cannons that would go out and...
And kill Christ?
No, not kill Christ, but... No, in all seriousness... Actually, in all seriousness, Jamie, would there would be some anti-Semitic acts of violence, and unfortunately
right.
there was one a week ago that had nothing to do with the film, but I was worried about that.
Now,
but
this is Last Temptation or
much,
Passion?
But I think America is a much more mature country than anyone gives it credits for, and I don't think this film, Bruno, I think people are going to laugh at it. I think they're going to have a good time. I don't think if they have these kind of stereotypes, these kind of feelings coming in before the film, I don't think this film is going to increase their any kind of anti feelings or any kind of stereotypes. I think they're going to go in, they're going to laugh, and then you know when they leave the film, the day after they may not even remember it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I honestly think.
I agree. Just like Borat, you know, I mean, Borat and Bruno both, I mean, it's obvious what they do is they present an extreme version of one type of character. Like Borat presents an extreme type of, you know, foreigner and exposes people who are xenophobic and racist and sort of is, yeah, he's the clown, but the butt of the joke is all the people who are unaccepting of him, actually.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Bruno will be the same way. He's the extreme clownish version of a homosexual. But the movie, I haven't seen it, but if it follows the same recipe as the Ali G show and Borat, then it's going to be making fun of all the homophobic people that he's going to come in contact with.
Yeah.
So I don't see how that's going to either harm or help. I mean, I guess potentially, at best case scenario, it could help by shedding some light on people that are homophobic.
Right.
But I don't. I find it hard to believe that it'll be too far in one direction or the other. I mean, it's a movie about you know a guy chasing other people with dildos and things like that.
Yeah.
It's not milk. You know, Milk comes out and Milk hardly has any sort of or Brokeback Mountain comes out. And these kind of movies don't really have one or the other effect on the culture in general.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult for me to believe that Bruno is going to. You know.
Do you think it'll do well?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I saw a preview for it on The Hangover, and
people couldn't stop laughing.
Yeah, people were going nuts. You know, I think it'll be very funny, and comedies have done very well this year. The Hangover did very well. The Proposal did very well.
The Proposal did bang up business. I think actually the bigger question is how many more characters does he have in him that he's going to be able to do this? I mean, I think he's running out of characters where he's going to, you know, people know who he is.
Yeah, it was difficult for him to do it this time,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, not only is he running out of characters, but I think even if he did one more of these types of movies, whether it was another Borat movie or another Bruno movie, the bit would run out of steam, too.
Yeah.
I don't think he'll continue to do that. He's a smart enough comedian that he'll reinvent himself. And, you know, do like he did with Sweeney Todd, little powerful performance. He'll go off and do more things like that. He's supposed to have been done School for Scoundrels, or Dinner with Schmucks, excuse me, not School for
Dinner with Schmucks. I like that. We went from School for Scouts.
Let it be said that our show, our listeners, got the first review of Public Enemies about an hour or two after the screening on Wednesday night. But the following day, it was published in the New York Post, the first published review of it, and it was a pan. The dude panned
really?
It. Yeah.
What
and did let
they
it,
like about it?
Let it be known that this generally is someone that doesn't like anything Michael Mann makes.
Now, who's this?
Who is this person?
New York Post. Lou.
Lou Lemonick.
Oh, well,
yeah.
God, my God. I mean, do people take him seriously?
Yeah, he's kind of a naysayer. He's kind of a... I'll say it. He's kind of an Armand White type.
Yeah. And I just want to say something about Keith's site. The house next door got one of the best plugs you could ever get, Wired Magazine. I was reading Wired Magazine yesterday, and I want to say Scott Rosenberg, the co-founder of Salon, is writing a book on blogging, the history of blogging. And in the interview, he said, I really like what those guys do at the house next door online.
Yeah.
Okay, so, and I sent Keith an email about this
on
Facebook, but, you know, just to let them know that the house next door, people are paying attention.
So he published a review. Well, that's great news. And he gave it a pan, said that, you know, there's a couple of great gun battle sequences, but outside of that, you couldn't care less about anybody in the movie. It's uninvolving. But the studio made him pull his review because there is a critical embargo on the film until the 25th. They
yeah.
can't publish their reviews until the 25th.
Mm.
Why show them the movie if you don't want them to publish a review? Why not show it? Why show the movie until you want them to publish a review? That's what I don't understand.
Yeah, you got to ask, if it was a glowing review, would the same demand have been?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. That's a good question.
But that's a good
I
point.
I highly
to bring
doubt
up,
it,
Jamie. That's a because there are they show these movies, the press screenings obviously well in advance, and you know you got to realize, well, not everyone's going to like it, you know.
Yeah.
So I've never understood how that works.
It is odd. It's always been like a difficulty too, because if you remember, Pauline Kael, I mean, she would review a movie while it was a work in progress, like
mm-hmm.
in Nashville.
Right.
Kind of forced the studio to release movies early in some cases. That was always a bit controversial.
On the
Go
same
ahead.
Hand, it kind of speaks to what a douche move it is on Lou Lemonick's part, because critics and journalists are well aware
yeah.
of those critical embargoes.
Right.
He knew what he was doing. He wanted to be the first voice out there. He wanted to get some press for himself. And I'm not saying that he didn't genuinely feel that way. Maybe he did genuinely dislike the movie. But he knew exactly what he was doing and just wanted to get his name out there first.
Right.
So I can't really, you know, I can't really side with either one. Haven't seen the movie. But if they show you this movie and say you can't publish your review till the 25th, well, he needs to wait till the 25th to publish his review.
Right.
Good or bad.
Right, like Roger Friedman with the Wolverine
yeah.
review.
Yeah. Yeah. They should have had a critical embargo throughout the film's entire run.
Yeah, that would have helped. Now, I have a question for both. I know you didn't, but I was just curious. Did anyone see The Proposal or Year One this weekend?
People in the chat room did.
Okay.
No,
I haven't
seen
either one, so I was just curious. But the funny thing is, like a week ago, I would have said, of the two, I would have leaned towards Year One. As of now, I would lean more towards The Proposal if I had a choice.
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm not going to lean either way, but Year One did.
But Chris, I thought of you because you like Ryan Reynolds, and I like Ryan Reynolds, and it seems like he might actually bring something to that genre that has been dormant for a long time.
Yeah, he could. It's possible, and I think he did when he made Definitely Maybe.
Yeah.
But it just doesn't look... you know, I mean, this movie, you can see the ending coming before you go see it, you know.
You can
like,
see the ending, like, from a year ago, but I mean...
Yeah. And Year One got some pretty awful reviews also.
I was shocked by how bad the reviews were for Year One. I was in everyone said in the beginning of the reviews, if you've seen History of the World Part One or Life of Brian, you don't need to go see this.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because there's a lot of... I love Jack Black. I love Michael Cera.
Mm-hmm.
I love Harold Ramis.
Yeah, I mean, it's really disheartening.
Apparently, there's a lot of cameos that just sort of come and go, and nobody really does anything funny or says anything interesting, and it just doesn't bring anything new to what, like you say, you know, a type of movie that has been made before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
by the way, we
mentioned... You could say that about The Proposal, too. It just doesn't
yeah.
bring it new, apparently, to a type of movie that's
been done before. But one good thing the one constant thread in The Proposal reviews, even the bad reviews, which obviously there are more of than good ones, is that Ryan Reynolds makes it worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought that was what you were talking about, Ryan Reynolds, earlier this year, and I just thought, you know, you were right about him.
Well, there's a big
yeah.
audience out there for romantic comedies, and frankly, I'm happy that the movie did well because I don't dislike Ryan Reynolds. In fact, I like him quite a bit, and I think Sandra Bullock while I'm not nuts about her movies, obviously a lot of people are. And
obviously the opposite sex is, yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, women love Sandra Bullock movies. And not just women, but for the most part women.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm happy that the movie did well. But again, where are you going to go from here? Like,
mm-hmm.
are you going to go make another one just like this? Is she going to go on a run like that and just keep
right.
making sort of movie over and over again? Same with Ryan Reynolds. He's sort of been on the cusp of becoming a really A-list star for, you know, quite a while now. So,
and
waiting for that performance that's going to push him over the edge.
And he's superb in Adventureland, even though it's a supporting part. He's excellent in that.
Yeah.
And he's very good in Definitely Maybe, which is one of the rare standouts in the rom-com genre.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was on my top 10 last year.
I
there
know. Jamie, I was about to bring that up, you know, just to... But, yeah.
Yeah. Another film that has been getting some negative press that comes out next month is... next month meaning August. If this were July, it would be next month. It's G.I. Joe. Which got the lowest scores in the history of that studio's history.
I think any studio's, from the way I was reading that. Well, it goes back to what we were talking about 2 years ago with Transformers, and it's directly tied into Transformers. There's a big article in the New York Times Arts and Leisure section today about both of these films. Like, the toys are basically where the stories are coming from, which I find kind of frightening. But... You know, if you've read these advanced reviews of the new Transformers film...
Not too good.
Not too good, but here's the thing. Okay, we know the first one. It's loud, it's got action, lots of special effects. But the one thing, Chris, and I know you might disagree with this, but it was not boring. You know, regardless of what... This one, the first thing that everyone... It's boring. That's not good for this kind of film. Forget
everything
else.
I just don't know. These movies are critic-proof, as I'm sure G.I. Joe is. I'm not sure that people want to see G.I. Joe to begin with, but I don't even know if Spielberg directed G.I. Joe if they'd be interested in it. But Spielberg didn't direct it. It was Stephen Sommers, who it's being reported that he has been fired from it because of the low test numbers, and they're bringing somebody else in there to try to fix it. Someone notable.
It was reported and then denied.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, was it? It was denied.
Yeah, it was denied, but you're right to bring that up. I just don't... Because if you looked at this article, there's a Monopoly movie being made, there's a Candyland movie, a big being made. What? All right, am I missing something? I know that there are a lot of great unmade scripts sitting in the shelves of these... A Monopoly movie? A Battleship movie? I mean, where's the Parcheesi movie? Where's the movie?
A Monopoly movie directed by Ridley Scott, no less.
I love Ridley Scott, but I think that's a big mistake. Go with the Alien prequel for that matter.
Yeah, it's a major obstacle just not to laugh at the idea.
I mean, I don't...
Well, they're making
happened?
A... They're actually working on a Ouija board movie, too, actually.
Yeah, I saw that, Chris, and thank you for bringing it up not to embarrass me, okay?
Well, they made Witchboard, if you remember Tawny Katane's heyday.
Some silence for Tawny Katane's great contributions to acting.
Yeah, it's not a surprise that they... Sorry, the English woman was in my ear there.
I don't blame you. She gets on my nerves, too. Yeah.
There's a built-in audience whenever you take a title, whether it's a game or a TV show or a remake of a movie. When you're making a movie from scratch, you have to build buzz from the ground level up. And this sort of taking a title that people know sort of builds the first two or three floors for you. You still have to build a movie around it, but this just sort of lays the foundation. It's just an easy way to go about it. Now, that doesn't mean that all of these are going to make great foundations for a movie, but it's just kind of... I understand why they keep making these types of things, because it builds those first couple of floors for you.
Yeah.
As Shelley told me, like, last week, with exclamation points, they're making a Teen Wolf remake.
Yeah, they're doing that.
Is that relevant at all?
I didn't care for the other ones. It's not like my... You know, I'm not going to say I have all of a sudden... I know this is this thing to say you have nostalgia for Teen Wolf or, you know, what we were talking about on Wednesday night with Red Dawn. I don't have nostalgia for these things, but can't we think of something new? Do we really need a Red Dawn? It's sort of outdated. It was outdated as of November of 1989.
Speaking of which, Indy 5 looks like it's a go. Shia LaBeouf said that Spielberg has cracked the MacGuffin, or whatever the main plot point of Indy 5.
Yeah, it's going to be called Indiana Jones and the $200 million Apology.
Whoop. All right, let me ask you guys this. Now, is it going to be Harrison Ford, or is it going to be Shia?
It's got to be Harrison Ford. I can't believe that they're going to make the Shia LaBeouf movie.
Yeah, it won't be Sheena, but I do think...
Sheena, wait, Sheena, that would be really cool. All right, never mind.
I do think what gives me hope is that Spielberg is the one that cracked the problem. That right there.
Right, no, of course.
Is enough to make me a little more hopeful than the alternative.
Of course.
2012, have you guys seen that trailer?
Yes, I have. I have a lot to say about that, but I'm not
okay.
Gonna... Oh, shit, you wanted me to say something. I work with a lot of people who believe that in this, sadly, or not at the same time, but I've worked with people in the job I've had for the last couple of years that believe in this stuff. And I just, it looks like, as far as a disaster spectacle goes, it looks like it delivers. I don't, beyond that, Jamie, I don't know what to say, but special effects-wise, and I have full disclosure, I have a friend who worked in the special effects department on this film, so it looks like they deliver on that front. Whether it's...
Well, I hope they do, because that looks like all the movie, what all the movie is.
It's Irwin Allen on space crack. I mean, that's what these films are. Roland Emmerich is Irwin Allen on a lot of space crack, it looks like. And this one looks like it is an apology for 10,000 BC. So, I got
to give... These are just more and more insufferable to me.
Yes, thank you. I agree entirely.
Okay,
it looks like the biggest.
I was deleted from a friend's list, so yeah, thank you.
It looks like the biggest piece of crap. Right, that being said, I'd love to talk to your friend.
He would still love to talk to us because he, you know, but, and I didn't even know that until he posted the trailer last week. I had no idea he was working on this film, but this film bugs me on a couple levels because I just know a lot of people actually really believe in this.
Yeah, I don't care about that.
Well,
I just
care about that.
I just, you know, how many, pretty soon we're going to run out of monuments to crash underwater in the movies.
What is his objection to the White House?
Well, and it's Roland Emmerich's, he has his own genre.
Yeah.
He, like you said, it's the new Irwin Allen. He's like, I destroy the planet every movie I make.
Incredibility.
Which, you know, that, exactly. That's his niche. Good actors, you know, Cusack in the lead of 2012.
Oliver Platt.
Hey,
yeah.
Transformers got great actors in it.
Right.
Yeah.
Wolverine
Chris,
had great actors in it.
Chris,
and
I
actually, I
want to
go back to Transformers. I hate to go back to Transformers again, but I want to go back to it real quick.
Okay.
Jerry said that these early reviews are saying that people are getting bored by the movie. And frankly, I was bored by the first movie. But I wasn't bored by the first hour. I was into it. And, you know, after so many explosions, I did start to get bored in that movie. I was quite bored by the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's numbing just seeing things blown up and these reaction sequences that go for 20 minutes. So I think these people are getting bored the same way I am. They just get, you count the first Transformers movie as the first 2 hours, and the second Transformers movie as the second 2 hours. They're getting bored by hour three, where I was bored after hour one.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean,
like,
it's
just,
not fresh anymore.
No, yeah, this movie, it never had a chance, like, because that's all it ever was. It's just blowing things up.
Let me ask you gentlemen this question. Do you believe it, as I do now, do you think that the trailer for Cloverfield stole the thunder from the first Transformers film?
No.
Well, obviously not. The first Transformers film was huge.
Oh, I know. I realize that, Chris. Jesus Christ. I mean, I'm not an accountant or anything, but I mean...
Okay,
no,
all right.
But do you think, as far as the narrative goes, did you... There was a sense, that trailer, which I didn't know about, and I usually consider myself, at least at that time, pretty hip on these internet things, stole the thunder for me. That trailer, I didn't know what that was, and I was just like, really, that looked really cool.
No, I can't agree, because, again, like, Cloverfield wasn't mining territory that had never been worked on before, but it sort of tackled it in a different way and brought something a little bit different to it. And also, let's keep in mind that Cloverfield did one of the most important things that movie did was to keep it short and sweet. That was a very short movie. Transformers did not do that.
No, and the second one is like 2.5 hours long.
Yeah. It's insufferable. Like Jamie said, these movies are just more and more insufferable.
Do you think 2012 is really going to be more of the same? Like, you think it's like basically if you watch the double feature of this and Transformers 2, you'd want to like just go out and blow your brains out?
I don't see how you could feel anything after you've sit through those movies.
They're just, and I think it's a lot of, to do with the CGI, frankly, too. We're not getting enough actual tactile stimulation on screen. We're not getting enough humans talking and discovering things and sort of working things out with one another. It's,
right.
Again, if you go back and watch the action in quotation marks, movies of the 70s and early 80s and 60s, those were action movies. They were called action movies, something like Dirty Harry. But they didn't have all this CGI. They didn't have all these special effects. So they were forced to make the characters interesting and their dialogue interesting and the choices they make were forced to be interesting. And the action sequences were the highlights, you know.
Thrilling on a human level.
Yeah, no,
right.
I agree with you 100%, Chris.
100%.
In an email dated May 4th, Michael Bay to Paramount head Brad Gray. Michael Bay complains that Paramount's ad campaign for Transformers 2 is ineffective. He says, "I have been waiting and waiting for the anticipation of an event movie to make it into the public zeitgeist, but the print campaign is an abject failure with a pathetic presence in the LA Times, and I'm particularly pissed off about the profile of the movie on the MTV Video Awards."
Oh my God, wow.
So that's...
Well, you know, what does he want? Does he want them to splice in scenes from Gone with the Wind? He made the fucking movie.
He only has himself to blame. I mean,
no, he's not complaining about the movie. He's complaining about the marketing of the movie not being...
I understand, but the marketing of the movie is nothing but action
sequences.
Based on
the movie he made.
The marketing of the movie is, like I said last week or 2 weeks ago, it's a minute of explosions and robots fighting each other, and then cut to a shot of sweaty Shia LaBeouf screaming, "Get out of there," or "Run," and then another minute of robots and Transformers fighting and explosions. Like, that's the movie that he made. The marketing campaign is accurate. Like, that's what they're selling. They're selling an accurate depiction. And I know that there's subtle differences in marketing campaigns, you know. You can subtly make something appear to be something maybe that it's not exactly, but this movie is that. It's just action. It's just pure adrenaline and pure robots. I don't know what...
He's right.
Yeah. Pixar, do you read about the big Pixar story from the week? We were talking about Up a little earlier.
This
is the moving story of the week. And it's everywhere, so I'm sure everyone's gotten a chance to see it. A 10-year-old girl that was dying of a very rare vascular cancer wanted to see Up, and she was unable to do so in the theater, and she was about to die, and she said, I can hang on if I'm able to see Up. And a Pixar executive flew to her house with a DVD and sat with her and her mother, and she watched Up a couple hours before she died. And then Pixar left, and apparently the executive that will go unnamed was visibly very, very moved and tear-stricken. And it had special importance to the mother, too, because the mother said she just kept thinking about the whole notion of Up and the balloons and going up, and she felt comforted that her daughter was going up to heaven after seeing that, you know. So that's good. Pixar, they're living by family values. I mean, that's like family values right
that
there.
That is.
None of this other
Pixar,
BS.
Like, can they do no wrong? I mean, they make long strings of really incredible and entertaining movies, and then they fly to, you know, dying children's houses and let them...
I
mean,
pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Speaking of dying, or actually she died not too long, about 10 years ago. No, she died right before 9/11, I think. Pauline Kael, last week would have been her 90th birthday. Did you celebrate anyway, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I celebrated by reading all of her work. No celebration at all.
I didn't celebrate either, Jamie. I feel really bad.
Yeah.
Well, Chris is a little less taken by Pauline Kael as myself and Jerry are.
Well, I'm not. I don't dislike Pauline Kael at all. But we talk about her
every day. Does that count?
Yeah.
Her name comes up in this household once a day. So does that count for anything?
Yeah. I mean, I think she's important and infuriating, and you know, but obviously her importance in the realm of criticism cannot be denied. But here's a couple of good zingers from some of her reviews to celebrate. Top Gun. She says, "What is this commercial selling? It's just selling because that's what the producers Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer and the director Tony Make It Glow Scott know how to do. Selling is what they think movie making is about. The result is a new art form, the self-referential commercial. Top Gun is a recruiting poster that isn't concerned with recruiting, but with being a poster."
Wow.
Blue Velvet. "The film's kinkiness isn't alienating. Its naivete keeps it from that. And its vision isn't alienating. This is American darkness, darkness in color, darkness with a happy ending. Lynch might turn out to be the first populist surrealist, a Frank Capra of dream logic."
Wow, I mean, you know,
we're
vacant. The criticism landscape is just vacant, man.
It is, yeah. Goodfellas. "The filmmaking process becomes the subject of the movie. All you want to talk about is the glorious whizzing camera, the freeze frames and jump cuts. That might be why young film enthusiasts are so turned on by Scorsese's work. They just don't respond to his films, they want to be him. When Orson Welles made Touch of Evil, the filmmaking process just about took over. That movie was one flourish after another, but that was 1958, and making a thriller about your own wallowing love of the film medium was a thrilling stunt. Dances with Wolves. There's nothing affected about Costner's acting or directing. You hear his laid-back surfer accent, you see his deliberate, goofy feints and falls, and all the close-ups of his handsomeness. This epic was made by a bland megalomaniac. The Indian should have named him Plays with Camera."
Wow. Wow, man.
Yeah, so there's good old Pauline Kael. All right, no discussion there, I guess.
No, dude, she was, you know, I mean, that's kind of why we have the show. We're all influenced by her to a certain degree, so, I mean...
Well, that's why you and I have the show.
No, Chris, too. Chris likes it, too. I you know, we don't... You know, one of the things I love about the last couple of weeks is that we have Chris back with us. And he's integral part of the show. I don't think anyone who listens to this... No, I am not, like, blowing smoke up your ass. I really mean that. That was one of the reasons that I think the show has lasted.
I agree. It's important that I'm back on the show.
No, it is.
I think so, too,
thank
man. I'm
you,
loving it.
Thank you for that megalomania. And, well, next week our guest will be James Cameron. I hope we'll have James Cameron on because...
James Cameron brings up something I'd like to talk about real quick.
Please.
Which is,
oh, shit.
Well, first of all, the Avatar trailer is going to be coming out soon. Which
on Transformers.
Movie?
Yeah.
What movie will be
Transformers.
You, really?
Yeah.
I'm going to make sure I get there early, like 2 hours before the movie starts. Okay.
I'm starting to feel, and a lot of people, I think, have been sort of talking about this on all the movie websites, that this movie, the expectations are a little bit too high for this movie, and I think Cameron is starting to sort of, in interviews, sort of try and hit the brakes on that a little bit and say, okay, well, you know, the revolutionary part of this filmmaking style might not necessarily be apparent on screen when you're
right.
watching it. And he's made a couple statements to that effect, I'm paraphrasing, but I wonder if maybe they're going to be able to build the kind of steam that this movie needs to be able to recuperate that budget. And I know budget's not everything, but... James Cameron has never made an unsuccessful movie, and I'm starting to worry that perhaps this could be the first one. Not because it's not good, but just because the expectations are...
It's so expensive.
It's very expensive, and the expectations are so incredibly high. I'm wondering if it could be his first box office failure or his first critical failure or both.
I have a $200 bet going on with Jason O'Brien. The first bet is that it will be the highest grossing movie that comes out this year. Now, that means that in June of next year, it could wind up being the highest-grossing movie of this year. But when all is said and done,
right.
then it'll make the most money.
Now, are you which side of that bet are you on? Are you betting that
you
it will be?
I'm betting that it will be. Okay. Second part of my bet, which is the second $100 of it, is that it will receive the most nominations.
It could.
So you think
it could? It could both.
Yeah.
You think this is going to be like a Star Wars or a Return of the King, like one of those genre pictures that crosses over?
Original
yeah.
Star Wars, right, Chris?
I'm sorry?
Original Star Wars. You're not talking about...
Original Star
okay,
Wars,
okay,
yeah.
I just want to know, maybe there's a parallel universe where the Phantom Menace did really well.
Oh, no, I just mean Star Wars, you know, A New Hope did very well.
Yeah, no,
it
okay,
also
no, I figured as much. I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah, it was nominated for the Oscar.
Yeah, I remember. I remember all that, yeah.
Yeah. That's a bold statement, Jamie. I mean, the first half is not as bold, the fact that it might be the movie to make the most money this year. I mean, that's bold, but not quite as bold as the second half.
Right.
The
second half
is really,
pretty bold.
You really believe that?
I'm betting on it.
Well, we're betting on it now, too, because you're our comrade in arms, so.
Thank
it's
you.
Hard to bet against Cameron.
That's just it. Why are people betting against Cameron?
I wouldn't
get it.
I wouldn't. I really would not.
Yeah. It's so tough, though. But at the same time, to bet against Cameron, it's kind of like betting against the Patriots, you know? It's like, yeah, they're great, and it's hard to bet against them, but they got to fall sometime, and eventually
right.
they did.
Yeah, but two things about this. First of all, we might all be very enthusiastically singing my tune next week after we see this trailer, as may Jason. Secondly... It is the almost, I would imagine, the antithesis of what 2012 will be. It'll be a major event picture, lots of visual effects, but without a limited mind and with a real artist at the helm.
See, I was trying to get a ticket to one of those like arcs that they have in 2012 to get off the planet, but okay, that made me feel better.
I don't disagree that the trailer, first of all, I don't disagree that the movie will be incredible. In fact, I think it will be, and not only do I think it will be, I hope it will be, because
yeah.
I love literally every one of James Cameron's film I'm a huge fan of. But I do worry about the fact that it has so much CGI, because if you look back, there's not a lot of films directed by a great artist like James Cameron or otherwise, which are, you know, which have this level of CGI in them, that are very good. And the person who made the best point about this, in my opinion, is Terry Gilliam, strangely enough.
Right.
When he was talking about Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which had a couple CGI shots in it. They had to recreate the old Vegas, you know, the 60s Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about CGI, and what he said was, it's a little tricky when you're, you know, the world as we know it was created by billions and billions of people. Everyone planted trees and built houses and created all these structures, and everything has touches from all these different minds throughout the history of mankind. When you create a world in CGI, you're creating it by how many people are creating this world. It's, you know, 10, 20, maybe even 100 people work on the CGI world, but there's not enough diversity for it to be truly as tangible and as palpably diverse as the real world is. And don't get me wrong, if anyone's going to create that kind of world that Terry Gilliam's talking about, it could be James Cameron, and I would bet on that. But I think it's an interesting point that the CGI movies, you get so oversaturated with, we saw it in Phantom Menace. How many scenes in that movie were just entirely digital?
Yeah,
you know,
I mean,
from the landscape to the characters to the action to everything that's going on, and it just feels phony. It feels phony, yeah. And I hope to God that this movie doesn't suffer from that.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe, like you do, Jamie, that it won't. But that is the fear.
Yeah, I'm fearful for him too. I mean, either way, I think he'll be all right.
I mean,
he'll be all right.
Come out on top.
Yeah, I think.
I'm rooting for you, Jamie. I'm rooting for you against the Oscar host.
Thank you, dude. There was one more thing I wanted to bring up, but I can't remember what it is. Oh, I wanted to bring up casting news about my man Pacino, because I haven't talked about it yet on the show. He signed up for so many new things, but the latest thing that he signed up for about 2 weeks ago is playing Dr. Kevorkian in an HBO movie directed by Barry Levinson.
Hell yeah. Why not? A 90s icon.
90s icon. Oh, Kevorkian or Barry Levinson?
No, Kevorkian.
Or Pacino.
Wait, I just put that British lady.
And by 90s icon, I mean Pacino was in his 90s.
Wow.
No, I'm a huge fan of Pacino.
We all are.
Does that excite you, Chris, that project?
Absolutely, it excites me to watch this story. But isn't it always kind of bittersweet when a movie is made through HBO? It's bittersweet for me because, first of all, you usually know that it's going to be a good product, whether it's a TV show or a movie. HBO just makes good products.
Yeah.
But it's kind of bittersweet in that when it's a movie like John Adams, or if it's a great TV show like John from Cincinnati, or any of the other great TV movies, Angels in America is another great movie that they made. These are great movies, but not a lot of people see them, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's true.
That's kind of the double-edged sword with the HBO movie. I have no doubt that this would be fantastic, but it's just a little bit unfortunate. At the same time, if they made a movie about Jack Kevorkian releasing in theaters, I don't think anyone would see it there either.
No, I don't. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
So maybe it is the best choice to go with HBO. Maybe that is the best platform for a movie like that. Either way, I think it's great casting, and Barry Levinson needs a comeback too.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, the two of them have never worked together, and I think it's an exciting project. I'm all for HBO films. I think that they make films that aren't viable in theaters.
That's true.
So they give him the best possible platform. And it's true, he hasn't ever worked with Levinson. I never thought about it before. There's so many good directors that Pacino has not worked with.
True.
Yeah, and his loyalty to the less-than-great directors is staggering as well. Scorsese is the tops, really.
Mm-hmm.
The quintessential New York actor,
I was watching Scorsese on Turner Classic Movies again this weekend because it's such an interesting documentary. And it just kept. I kept thinking about it over and over again. I don't know why. They don't reference Pacino in that documentary, but why has he never worked with him? I know that I think they've sort of flirted before.
They came close on Modigliani, but they never did. Yeah. Speaking of which, it's interesting, like directors that almost worked with someone or almost did a film, like Todd Phillips almost directed Borat. He worked a week on Borat.
Yeah, I know.
It was all scripted, but he had a different approach in mind. He didn't want to do the kind of the undercover camera kind of approach. It was all very scripted. So he left and gave back his fee, which also he worked for free on The Hangover.
Right.
But he's part owner of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
He's not taking a percentage. He's part owner of it, which means he gets an even bigger cut, and this will easily be a $200 million grosser. So Todd Phillips is very, very wealthy overnight with this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, the movie's made about $154 million thus far for a comedy that costs, I'm guessing, around $30 million or something like that.
Right.
So that sounds about right. That's a huge, huge return for this movie. So that's really cool because I've liked Todd Phillips' movies from Road Trip
So,
I mean, that's really neat. Good for him, frankly.
Yeah.
He's a good guy. Maybe we'll probably see more raunchy comedies now as a result.
Yeah, well, that hasn't really gone away since it sort of popped up with There's Something About Mary, unfortunately.
Yeah,
that's
true.
And it's never really been done as well. I mean, I think there's a few cases where it's been done very well, like There's Something About Mary or Me, Myself, and Irene, in my opinion, or The Hangover is another one, but for the most part, the good to bad ratio on the raunch comedies is about the ratio with the romantic comedy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you'll see another raunchy comedy next year, June 5th.
Well,
you'll probably see Hangover 2.
Right?
Yeah, that's probably what you'll see.
Yeah.
Well, anything else, guys? Jerry, you have anything you want to talk about?
No, that's it, man. That's all I got.
All right, Jerry's ready to go. Chris, you got anything?
What comes out this week? What's this week?
It's the Transformers and My Sister's Keeper, the big releases, but Moon is supposed to come out, I think, in the Expanse. So that's what I'm looking for.
Since we've discussed possible openings for Transformers, I propose that we predict openings for Transformers again.
Yeah, we should.
Okay.
We should. 5-day, it opens on Wednesday, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's the record for 5 days? Do we know?
Oh, God, I don't know, man. I'm at a loss, actually.
I think The Dark Knight is the record, because that's what they're saying that Transformers will beat.
Oh, God, I hope not. It's bad enough they're referring to the movie as T2 now in some circles.
What? Yeah.
They're referring to the movie as T2 in some circles.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, as it stands for Turd 2, unfortunately.
Yeah, no.
All right, I'm going to get you that information. The opening weekend for The Dark Knight. The Dark Knight opened on a Thursday, maybe?
Mm-hmm. I think. I'm not positive.
So Transformers opens on Wednesday or
it
Thursday?
Opens on a Wednesday, and the first one opened on a Wednesday. So I'm going to say maybe like is it going to be $120 million are we looking at, or
is it all day Wednesday or just a midnight?
All day Wednesday, because Tuesday night they start sneaking in at midnight. So
opening weekend of Dark Knight grossed $158 million. Hmm. Opening weekend of the first Transformers grossed $70.5 million.
Oh, God. Hmm. I'm going to say $110 million.
Yeah, it sounds about right. I'm going to go a little bit over. I don't want to go over Dark Knight, so I'm going to say $120 million,
mm-hmm.
because I want to believe that there is a God that will not let Transformers beat Dark Knight.
Yeah, I'm going with that God, man.
I'm going to go with $120 million.
Okay, we have 105, we have 120. I'm going 135.
Wow, okay.
135. You usually take the under, but this time you're taking the over.
Yeah, you're taking the big over.
It just reflects my my non-belief in the intelligence of people.
Well,
so there you go. Okay,
right
well.
Now, they won't be
we'll
getting
be back
$100.
On Wednesday night. Are we coming? We're coming back Wednesday night, aren't we?
I don't know yet.
Okay. Well, we'll be back next Sunday, that's for sure.
And we will review the Transformers gross on next Sunday.
Okay.
So we'll have it all then. And we also have legendary acting coach next Sunday, D.W. Brown. He still coaches people like Jeff Goldblum and other great actors. And he's a great actor himself. He'll be on. And then we'll celebrate the new Classics Casino.
Yay!
I think the second week of July. And then we're planning some other stuff, including one interview, Jerry, I need to tell you about, that we're having to audition for.
Okay, cool.
It's the craziest thing. All right, guys, thank you both for joining me.
All right, good night.
Thank you.
Good night, and thank you, everyone, for listening tonight. We appreciate
Jerry's
got to
take a shit.
No, I'm just, like, saying good night. I mean, I'm just saying good night. It's a great thing to say, but
that's cool.
All right, guys. I'll see you next Sunday.
Okay. Good night.
Bye-bye.